The rise of fascism reversed suddenly the idea that human history was an inevitable progress. It was all the more shocking because it involved the direct brutality of physical violence against individuals. Historical and individual fate for millions of people became identical. Not only were social classes defeated, but survival for entire human groups became problematical. A scientific understanding of fascism is clearly a prerequisite for the successful combating of it. Nor is our understanding merely a reflective exercise, for the dominant theory of investigation will have the effect of boosting the self-confidence of particular social classes, while at the same time reducing their political and moral vulnerability to attacks from hostile social classes. Fascism was able to develop successfully because its real nature was not understood, and because the dominant theory of the time was either false or incomplete. Fascism in Germany, Spain, and Italy was not the work of any blind forces of fate, inaccessible to action by people and social classes, but rather as a product of economic, political, and ideological relationships between the various social classes under capitalism. These are understandable, and we are capable of understanding them. It follows, therefore, that phenomenon would have made the fight against fascism significantly easier. But theory alone is not enough. In order to get results, it must grip the masses. The bureaucracies that ruled the mass working class organisations were able to insulate the masses from an adequate theory of fascism and the use of a workable strategy that this included. For their mistakes, the bureaucrats suffered annihilation. But the price humanity paid was much higher. The Second World War left 60 million people dead. While study of the national form that fascism takes is relevant, it must be undertaken within a framework which has first determined whether the fascist dictatorship tends to maintain or destroy, consolidate or undermine the social institutions of private property in the means of production, and the subordination of workers who are forced to sell their labour power under the domination of capital. It's true that fragments of pre-capitalist, guild and semi-feudal ideologies of earlier times play a not insignificant role in the ideology of fascism and in the mass psychology of the de-classed petty bourgeois that is the social base of fascist mass movements. But to proceed from this to suggest, as some do, that the character of fascism is, quote, the aggressiveness rooted in human nature, says nothing, for such aggression is expressed in countless different historical movements. Rather, fascism imposes on that aggressiveness a particular social, political and military form which has never existed before. Accordingly, fascism is indeed a product of imperialist monopoly capitalism. All attempts to interpret fascism in primarily psychological terms suffers from this fundamental weakness. Even less satisfactory is the view that sees fascism in terms of the characteristics of a particular people, or races, or of a particular historical past. How does one, for example, square the German military tradition with the complete absence of such a tradition in Italy? If hatred of the Jews is a primary feature of fascism, why were the Jews in Italy largely left alone by Mussolini? Again, Italy was industrially relatively backward country, whereas Germany was the most highly industrialised country in Europe. As secondary features and causes, these features have undoubtedly played a role in conferring upon fascism a specific national character, corresponding to the historical particularity of monopoly capitalism, and of the petty bourgeoisie in each particular country. Fascism is a universal phenomenon which has roots in all imperialist lands and can strike roots at any time. Attempts at explanation that emphasise this or that national peculiarity are wholly inadequate. The superiority of the Marxist method rests in its ability to successfully integrate contradictory elements which reflect a contradictory social reality. Adherence to Marxism, of course, doesn't guarantee a successful analysis, but it does make such an analysis possible. Trotsky's analysis of fascism can be broken into six elements, which must be understood in connection with one another. Let me detail these. Firstly, the rise of fascism is an expression of a severe social crisis of capitalism, a crisis of overproduction like the 1929-39 crisis, which goes beyond a temporary fluctuation of fortunes and goes to the relationship by which profit is realized. That is, where capital cannot continue in the competitive world market with a given level of wages, labor productivity, and access to raw materials and market. The function that fascism performs in this situation is to suddenly and violently change the conditions of the production and the realization of profit to the advantage of decisive groups of monopoly capital. From 1924 to 1929, big business subsidizes the fascist bands just enough to keep them from disappearing. They were not immediately required. They would be kept in reserve for a later date. And when the crisis of world capitalism blossomed into full force in 1929, the bourgeoisie began to turn more and more to the extra-parliamentary fascist gangs. But in both its infancy and until late in the piece, it was the heavy industrialists alone who subsidised and egged on the fascist movement, whereas light industry, or the finished goods industry, were never quite as enthusiastic about the fascists and initially were hostile to them. This was for several reasons. Firstly, the organic composition of capital invested in heavy industry is much higher than in light industry. That is, the ratio of capital invested in plant raw materials to wages is much higher. This means that the range of profitability realized from the surplus value created by the workers is that much more limited, and strikes leading to loss of production mean losses mounting into millions. If the economic crisis sharpens, they are unable to cut their fixed costs and therefore can only reduce their wages bill. The light industrialists, with their lower ratio of capital to wages, were less vulnerable to short strikes. Furthermore, the fact that they produced goods primarily for consumption made them fear that a savage cutback on the wages bill would have a bad effect on the purchasing power of the masses. They therefore preferred industrial peace, whereas heavy industry wanted to pursue the class struggle until the workers and their organisations were crushed. For this to be achieved, a strong dictatorial state was required, a development that light industry feared. Whatever the difference in strategy, the commitment of fascism to capitalism can be seen in the growth of corporate wealth from profits of 6.6 billion marks from all industrial and commercial enterprises in 1933 to 15.5 billion marks in 1938. Further, by destroying the organised workers' movement, Hitler achieved a wage freeze that would be the envy of John Howard. Wages for the whole period of the Reich were below the pre-crisis level, even though there was a severe labour shortage. Furthermore, the share of capital, interest and profits that is, rose from 17.4% of the national income in 1932 to 25.2% in 1937 to 26.6% in 1938. However, the number of corporations sharing these profits declined. Fascism not only did not break down the development of monopoly capitalism, it established near-ideal conditions for its future growth and development, and assisted it further by direct state investments. Second, in the epoch of imperialism, state power is an important tool in the struggle for world markets. Where the workers' movement has gone through a long historical development, the bourgeoisie exercises its political rule most advantageously through the bourgeois parliaments, parliamentary democracy we call it, which can reduce social antagonisms by granting certain social reforms. Such reforms are granted usually by social democrat or labour governments, who are thereby able to confine working class aspirations within the framework of capitalist society. The bourgeoisie desire the social democrats only for so long as they retain a mass support in the working class and can actually perform this role. The bourgeois parliamentary system also allows an important section of the bourgeoisie to participate directly in the exercise of political power through bourgeois parties, newspapers, universities, employers' associations, local and state governments, and the financial and industrial hierarchy. Far from being the only form of bourgeois rule, the parliamentary form depends upon the maintenance of a highly unstable equilibrium of social forces. When the bourgeoisie is unable to offer further minor concessions and feels compelled to attack working class wages and conditions in order to maintain a falling rate of profit, and the social democrats can no longer contain working class resistance, the bourgeoisie will try to establish a higher form of centralization of the state's executive power, even to the stage where direct political rule by the bourgeoisie themselves is actually excluded. This is the function of fascism, which it has only been able to perform by an extensive political expropriation of the bourgeoisie themselves from government. Thirdly, because of the numerical predominance of wage workers, it's nearly impossible for this violent centralization of power to take place, much less the liquidation of most of the gains of the workers' movement, including, of course, the mass organization of the working class. All these things can no longer be achieved within the framework of bourgeois parliamentary rule. Neither a military dictatorship nor a pure police state can for any length of time demoralize a class with millions of members, nor can these forms prevent for long the simple class struggles that are produced by market conditions. To be able to achieve its ends, the bourgeoisie needs a movement that can set masses of people on their side, that can wear down, isolate and demoralize the most aware parts of the working class by mass terror, street warfare, and that being done, can, after the seizure of power, totally crush the mass workers' organizations. The mass fascist bands then supervise and control the conscious wage workers. They can also ideologically influence the more backward workers, particularly the white-collar workers. 4. Such a mass movement can only rise on the basis of the petty bourgeois, a class situated between the working class and the bourgeoisie. The workers see their enemies in the plant, but the small trader, the shopkeeper and the small farmer see themselves as the victim of both big business and the unions. Their grievances are not against a definite enemy, but generalized and negative. They're therefore open to demagogy that uses radical and often anti-capitalist rhetoric. If the petty bourgeois is hard hit by inflation, bankruptcy of small firms, mass unemployment of university graduates, young workers thrown out of work, and in 1932, a third of the unemployed were under 24, technicians and the higher salaried employees falling into disrepair, then the typically petty bourgeois movement with its ideological reminiscences and psychological resentment will arise. It will combine extreme nationalism, verbal anti-capitalist rhetoric, directed not against private property as such, but against particular forms of capitalism, and the ones that affect them directly, such as money lenders, banks and department stores. They are easy prey to a scapegoat mentality. And in Germany, this was the Jews, who were an assimilated minority of 1% of the population. After the First World War, refugees from the Baltic areas added fuel to the preoccupation of Hitler and the fascist gangs. Add to this an intense hatred of the organized workers' movement, particularly as many of these leaders were of Jewish background. Once this movement begins physical attacks on the workers' movement, a fascist movement is born. Once it has reached a certain level on its own, it needs the financial and political support of important sectors of monopoly capitalism, particularly the decisive heavy industry, if it's to carry through to the seizure of power. 5. Before the fascist dictatorship can fulfill its role, the workers' movement must be ground down and beaten back before the seizure of power. This is only possible if, prior to the seizure of power, The scales have been tipped decisively in favour of the fascist bands and against the working class. The bourgeoisie, to quote Trotsky, likes fascism as little as a man with aching molars likes to have his teeth pulled. End of quote. Because the option of fascism creates the situation of all or nothing politics. If the fascists succeed in smashing the organised workers' movement, then it will succeed. But if the workers' movement seizes the initiative and strikes back, then it can defeat not only the fascists, but the capitalist system that spawns it. At first, the fascists organise only the most desperate parts of the petty bourgeois, while the petty bourgeois masses and the unorganised part of the wage workers, the unemployed, the young workers, waver backwards and forth between the two camps. They will follow the side that shows the greatest boldness and decisiveness. If the working class is unable to resolve this structural crisis of capitalism in its own interest, that is, if it does not seize the chance of a victory because it is split, misled or demoralised, then fascism will triumph. 6. If fascism succeeds, quote, like a battering ram in smashing the workers' movement, end of quote, then it has served its purpose so far as monopoly capitalism is concerned. Its mass movement is bureaucratised and largely absorbed into the state apparatus. The most extreme sections of the plebeian petty bourgeois, these people now represent an obstacle to this assimilation. And in Germany, they were ruthlessly eliminated in the Night of the Long Knives in 1934. With them, the verbal anti-capitalism is finally buried. The centralised state apparatus becomes more and more independent of the party ranks, and the all-or-nothing politics of fascism are carried over from the social-political sphere into the financial sphere. It encourages permanent inflation and finally allows no alternative but foreign military adventure. This produces a worsening in the economic situation and in the political position of the petty bourgeois, a pronounced acceleration in the concentration of capital and in the proletarianisation of the middle classes. We see that the class character of the fascist dictatorship does not correspond to the fascist mass movements. The dictatorship represents the interests of monopoly capitalism, not those of the petty bourgeois. This of necessity shrinks the active mass base of fascism, and the greatly reduced fascist bands lose their independence and become appendages of the police. Fascism is transformed back into a particular kind of Bonapartism, that is, dictatorship without the mass petty bourgeois base that distinguishes fascism. This is based on many of the ideas contained in Ernest Mandel's introduction to Trotsky's writings on Germany.